just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Management. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we're here to talk with you about the markets, the economy, and hopefully give you some good insights into all the things in those areas that have been going on lately. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. We aren't going to be telling you the same things you hear over and over again. We like to give you some insights into what we think is really going on. So right now, we'll start with the data dump. How did we end the week? Well, the week was pretty good. The Dow closed Friday up 130 points at 36,247. The S&P made a 52-week high. That's at 4,604. The NASDAQ traded higher at 14,403. The Russell 2000 rose to 1,880. Soft white wheat ticked up to $6.92 a bushel. U.S. Treasury rose. It's at 4.23% right now. Crude up a little bit as well at $73.31 a barrel. Gold down somewhat to the tick up in interest rates at $2,019 an ounce. And silver ended the week at $23.31 an ounce. Now, we learned yesterday that the jobs report for November came out, and we added 199,000 folks to the payrolls. That was more than what was anticipated, and certainly more than what we added in October when we added 150,000 people. The national unemployment rate also dropped down to 3.7% from 3.9% last month, and we saw hourly earnings rise by 4%. So, all in all, a pretty good report. Now, I, with all the backing and filling that's been going on politically and, how would I say, everywhere else, I thought I'd, instead of looking at individual stocks or certain segments of the economy, etc., I want to spend this show basically giving you the proverbial big picture overview of why I and, well, I guess our firm look at the markets in a positive manner, and hopefully to disabuse some folks of some of the negativity that they're dealing with right now. Now, my question is that now, after this two-year string of seemingly open-ended negative trends and developments, where do we find ourselves? Well, like I said, let's look at the big picture. And this past week, we learned that the third quarter GDP figures, the last revision, showed growth of 5.2%. The initial reading was just 4.9%, which all by itself is pretty good. And that brought our year-over-year economic growth to 3%. That's the highest we've had since the first quarter of 2022. So, very good development. Then, about a week ago, at the end of November, S&P 500 had put up its highest close since the bull market started in 2022, that is up until yesterday, and the Dow, including dividends, ended at a new total return high, and yes, the NASDAQ managed through the end of November about a 33% increase in its value. I'd say those are pretty good trends. Now, in terms of coming attractions, the Bank of America said that since 1936, the S&P 500 has put up positive returns 78% of the time. Even following a strong November, the S&P was still higher by 1.1% on average, they say. So in November, basically everything except for crude moved higher. And while not great for the oil-related investments, the lower crude price was very helpful in putting downward pressure on both the inflation and interest rates, as well as kind of mitigating concerns about the Fed raising rates, also known as tightening. It was one of the best market months ever. I mean, ever. And I've seen a lot of market months, and it was a pretty dang good one. So, as of yesterday, the price for oil had fallen for six of the last seven sessions. Again, it was up just a bit yesterday. And this is happening despite the OPECers threatening to cut supply next year. Now, I should add that those folks do not have a great record of following the production goals they've agreed to, up or down. But right now, there's just too much supply out there and really not enough global demand. And lower oil has a major effect on our economy. According to AAA, the average price at the gas pump has dropped to $3.20 a gallon. Now, that's the lowest price in nearly a year. And I looked around, and here's some more specific numbers. The highest price in the country is California at $4.73. Hawaii, and this is average prices, of course, at $4.70. Then a place called Washington is in number three at $4.29. The neighbors in Oregon are paying $3.94, while across the street in Idaho, they're paying just $3.47. And again, we had record high production in September. So I'll let you figure out why those prices are so high on your own. But in any case, I think another reason for the fall of oil prices has been worries about a slowdown in demand from, again, the so-called weaker global economy. But the big concern isn't with us, it's with China. And while falling oil can be bad for energy companies, again, there are some beneficiaries. Lower prices at the pump are great for travelers and consumers as we get into the holiday shopping season. Now, historically, wars in the Mideast have sparked rallies in oil. Not this time. The price for oil is down about 10% since the OPEC's called for voluntary production cuts. However, in spite of the positive market moves and economic reports, it appears that a whole lot of investors of all shapes and sizes seem to have decided to close their eyes and ears to these current market trends and, for reasons best known to them, hope all this good news goes away. Now, I put in the part about good news, but they do seem to... They're not admitting what's going on around them. Now, the University of Michigan publishes a monthly consumer sentiment survey. This year, it has been consistently at very low levels. And again, this in spite of what's going on in the economy. This suggests a very strong recency bias, meaning what happened most recently is going to continue to be happening forever and always. Amen. Now, that works both ways. When things are going really great, that also comes to play. Nonetheless, the heavy negativity shown in these surveys has historically been a bullish signal for stocks. The worst part is what they're doing instead of staying in their well-diversified portfolios of the high-quality companies of the U.S. and the world. And I'll get into that more in just a minute. What a difference in perspectives from just a month ago. The reason for the new optimism, if you will, is now the widespread expectation that the Fed has finished its job, will ride nicely into the sunset. Well, despite all its tough talk about being vigilant against inflation, market's not buying it. Because not that long ago, the Fed was telling us to expect another rate hike before the end of the year. Well, next Wednesday, the Fed meets again, and they will be making an announcement about interest rates. Mr. Powell will be having a news conference, I think on Wednesday, perhaps Thursday. Nonetheless, that will be happening. And don't expect any changes to interest rates. I believe the policy statement will be out Wednesday afternoon. But not only that, the futures market, now those are all the traders getting together and making their projections. This is not some magic guarantee. But nonetheless, the futures market thinks there's an 89% chance that the Fed will cut rates by May. So the equation is pretty simple. Low rates make the stocks happy. Now, this has been the theme of this week. Markets ignoring what the quote-unquote officials have to say. Stock markets ignoring the Fed. Oil traders ignoring the OPEC. The net result has been drifting markets that we've seen these last few weeks. So, what have many investors been doing? Well, it appears that what they haven't been doing is remembering that investing is a long-term situation, not day-to-day. If you look at the mountain charts, those are the charts that go up from left to right and typically rise. That's why they look like a mountain. And you see how the indices have done over time. Well, if you're trying to be in and out, you're going to get one result. But if you want to ride a pony the rest of the way through, take a look and see what they've done over time. You know, most people invest long-term for their retirement, whether to come or already underway. What have investors been doing in the middle of all this confusion, shall we say? Well, it appears they haven't, again, remember that it's a long-term situation, that is, for retirement. You know, when you invest for your retirement, whether it's to come or already there, you know, that's what most people are investing for. And in today's reality, 30-year retirements or longer are happening with increasing regularity. So you have to plan accordingly. You can't play it too cozy and expect the money to be able to grow over that length of time. However, however long your retirement proves to be, reacting to headlines and current events are both great ways, in quotes, to work against themselves by reducing your long-term balances. Now, let's consider what I think to be the biggest potential drag on growing your assets. Stocks have had solid year-to-date gains, but many people, investors, seem to be happy to hide out in their money market funds, this according to Bank America. Stephen Suttmeyer, he's a chief equity technical strategist, so obviously he knows what is up. Anyhow, Stephen says, even after a 28% rally on the S&P 500 from the October 22 low and an 11% rally from the index's late October 23 low, investors still love cash. Well, in the 10-year Treasury, which again is kind of the bogey for money markets, auto loans, car loans, lots of things, but that's why you hear it referenced so many times. Anyhow, the 10-year Treasury went from a low of 3.3% this spring, shot up to 5% for no apparent reason whatsoever, and then yields have now moved back to yesterday it closed at 4.2% for the 10-year Treasury, and that was done relatively quickly. Now, that was done not by the Fed. That was the market that did that. So that move pushed short-term T-bills and other short-term debt instruments up because, again, interest rates, excuse me, bond prices go opposite of the direction of interest rates. So it pushed him up, and in some cases to 5% or higher, helping to create this hideout mentality. You say, shoo, 5%, that sounds good. Well, the thinking of these investors is apparently that with all this seeming uncertainty, they can be, quote-unquote, safe by moving money into these type securities. This strategy, I guess some would call it, is referred to as the T-bill and chill strategy. Maybe DQ should be selling one of those. Get your T-bill and chill. Anyhow, apparently it's not a big secret because according to Morningstar, $900 billion in money market deposits were made for the 12 months through the end of October this year. Market technician J.C. Peretz says we're hitting new records in money market fund deposits with about $6 trillion in total assets. So $900 billion for the last 12 months, but right now, the total sitting in money markets of all types is $6 trillion. Now, 3.6 has come from institutional investors. Those are the mutual funds, retirement plans, things of that nature. And the remaining $2.2 trillion from folks, individuals. So that's a whole lot of dry powder for future use. So now let's take the Paul Harvey approach and look at the rest of the story. The parts that many of these money market commandos are either unaware of or choose to ignore. Investing in these three-month treasury bills, what's currently at about 5.3%, come with their own set of things to consider. First are the taxes. T-bills are exempt from state and local taxes, but not Fed tax. So there are some tax-free money market funds out there and short-term muni bonds that may work for higher-income folks. And you get inflation risk. See, there's no guarantee that your return of your fixed income instrument, whatever it is and whatever rating it is, because the return stays fixed as long as you own it, there's no guarantee that your return will be better than inflation during the time you own it. So historically, again, according to Morningstar, it said cash might stay ahead of long term inflation, but not by an appreciable amount. It averaged only a 0.6, that's 0.6, not even 1%, 0.6 return from 1954 through the 31st of October this year. I don't know that I'd be happy with that kind of number. Now, one risk that many overlook is that of reinvestment. You know, you'll receive your initial rate until your investment comes due, whether it's 3 months or a year or 10 years or what have you. However, what you do and the money you put into the short-term stuff comes due. What happens then? Well, there's no guarantee that you'll be able to put that same money into an item that is paying the same rate or higher, because the rates adjust daily depending upon, again, primarily how the 10-year treasury is priced. So probably their biggest risk is that of these investors is that regarding opportunity cost. The fact that investing in cash and equivalents doesn't help build your long-term wealth, even when those yields seem relatively attractive. You could say that since T-bills and CDs qualify as what are term-safe investments by conventional wisdom, they aren't seen as capable of providing strong returns. Well, then again, that's pretty normal. Safe doesn't usually mean strong return. If you got something that's considered really safe, assume you got a real skinny return. If you got something that's really speculative, well, that's going to have a higher return to pay you for the risk. But over the short term, less than a year, this can pay off over some of those periods. But it's not the way to build long-term wealth. The other area that's attracted attention is the gold market. Now, by way of full disclosure, to this point, over 50 years, I have never invested in gold or miners, either for my clients or me, and nor will I. However, I believe it's helpful to provide you some insight into what's been driving it. Gold's advanced for 7 of the past 8 weeks and has now up year-to-date 11%. That puts gold futures on track for their best performance since 2020, when the bug crushed the market and lifted precious metals by 24%. The challenge, of course, becomes when do you sell? If you're going to buy this stuff, and most people, if they're trading, do the ETF approach, because otherwise it's coins and bullion, and those are a little harder to maneuver. But in any regard, this past Monday, gold did hit an all-time what's called nominal price of $2,135 an ounce. That was on bets that the Fed would be cutting interest rates. So the gold bugs were happy. You see all those little gold things with little smiles on them? Okay. But then it dropped by about $100 as there's uncertainty about when those rate cuts may occur. Anticipation of this Fed easing seems to be the biggest driver of the gold price right now. And people historically, typically, have often bought gold as protection against inflation. But inflation is falling. So I'm protecting against falling inflation? That doesn't compute. Further, in addition to not paying any dividends or interest ever, gold has not proven very good at protecting from inflation. And here's an example, using the price of gold itself. The high point for gold came in the mid-1970s, when Mr. Nixon took the controls off and let the stuff float. And coincident with that happening was very high inflation and interest rates, both at record levels. Now, adjusted for inflation, the price that, remember the nominal price Monday, they said the all-time high, and everybody's all, ooh, look, $2,135. However, if you adjust it for inflation, the high price, which was in the mid-70s, tells us that that value was $3,333 an ounce. And last time I heard, $2,135 is less than $3,333, so not a great inflation hedge. The high point for gold in terms of its price per ounce came in the mid-70s. And again, high inflation, high interest rates, they were both at records at the time. And last Monday, I think it was, is that what I said? Yeah, last Monday, gold hit an all-time nominal high of $2,135. Nominal means just the number. If you adjusted for inflation, adjusted back to inflation, the high price in the mid-70s equates to $3,333 an ounce. So, to me, that's a pretty dang poor inflation hedge. And the prospect that interest rates might have peaked is helping those gold prices move to record highs because, again, the gold people don't seem to pay any attention to the fundamentals. They just say, oh, it's going up, hooray. Anyway, gold also attracts those seeking to hide out from economic downturns. But here again, the economy remains strong and expectations it will slow just moderately have also been helping to push up the stock prices. So let's consider facts and opinions. Let me try that again. Facts and not opinions of where we are now. This willful blindness on behalf of investors is one reason why historically speaking, they generally underperform the indices. If you don't believe me, you can go Google something called DALBAR, D-A-L-B-A-R. They track how folks do it on compared with indices if they're in growth mutual funds or income mutual funds. And it's just general. It's not by companies, not by Fidelity or Vanguard or whoever. It's just by type of fund. And they compare it with the indices. And how have they done? And without exception that I can recall, and they've been doing this probably since the 70s at least, there's never been a time when individuals have outperformed the indices because they get in their own way. Okay? That's why. They ignore the history of long-term investing as well as what's actually happening and give in to decisions that are driven by their conflicting emotions. I think one of the toughest jobs I have as an advisor is to help our clients to become what Nassim Taleb, I can't remember that guy's name, but they called him Dr. Doom back in 08. But anyhow, what he calls anti-fragile people, anti-fragile. These people actually do increase their ability to thrive as a result of stressors, shocks, and volatility. You too can be an anti-fragile person. Because one way to do it, train yourself to consider what the market may be actually perceiving that you may be missing. So perceptions are reality, so I'd say work on yours. So then why not bonds for long-term goals? I mean, they're safe. Safe in the sense, see, U.S. Treasuries are the best investment in the world because they're guaranteed you'll get your money back and you'll get paid in the interim. Any other bond? Not so much. And so because bonds have typically, historically, mostly paid their interest regularly and paid off when they came due, they're considered safe. But there's other things to consider. For instance, if you do need a specific amount of money within 3 years for whatever purpose, it's usually a pretty good idea to park it either in a money market or a short-term issue so you know that it will absolutely be there when you need it. Sure, you know, you could put it in the stock market and cross your fingers, but if you absolutely for sure need it, you know, a trip, a vacation, a wedding, who knows? Don't take the chances. It's not to your advantage. You don't want to have an ulcer too. You just want to have the benefit of whatever those assets are going to bring you. Now, conventional wisdom has it that we people generally regard the debt of the United States Treasury as safe. And as I just said, it is the safest financial asset in the world. Absolutely. This even in spite of sharing many of the same reasons short-term fixed income investing has risks with inflation and taxes and all that other fun stuff. Having the majority of your long-term assets in fixed income, unless those assets are quite substantial, and I mean quite substantial, will likely not allow you to meet your needs. The historical record shows that bonds, in general, provide a minimal positive return over inflation over time and are nowhere close in terms of total returns from stocks. Total returns, again, growth plus dividends. And with the bonds, you have inflation risk, you know, that your coupon rate, your interest rate won't be enough to, beat the inflation rate. And then when the bond comes due, we'll be able to make as much as you did before. You know, two twos don't make a four. All right. I mean, it's just not the same. So that you'd have to adjust your cash flow and your living and all that other stuff. So there are many, I think, solid reasons why you don't want to get overly concentrated in fixed income. Okay, Mike. So then again, why stocks, even in uncertain times? Well, the first reason is we never know when certain times will return and the markets begin to settle down. And your perceptions about how well the market has done over time are likely being influenced by the talking heads and the crises du jour. For example, as of yesterday, I believe I mentioned this earlier, the S&P closed effectively at its high, having gained just about 20% since the first of the year. Once again, willful blindness. Give me that 5%, but you can leave that 20% over on the side because, ooh, it's too scary. Sorry. In my 50 years in the biz, I can assure you that I've seen many problems that we, the world, and the markets have had to deal with. How these crises will be resolved now? Neither obvious nor predictable. Who knows? Yet the index of the values of the 500 of the world's most successful companies doesn't seem as bothered as it isn't even classically a defined correction from its all-time high. It hasn't sold off. The wars, be they in Israel or Ukraine, little to no effect. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's reality. That's just how they are. This isn't an exception. So why does a portfolio of these 500 companies continue to do so well over time? Well, I think a big reason is that the essential mission of a profit-seeking public company is to preserve its shareholders' capital. And nothing can force it to continue losing money. It'll simply stop doing anything. It'll shut down before they, you know, if they are being forced to do something that causes them to lose money, they're going to say, nah, we're not going to do that anymore. Now, beyond that, successful businesses will continually innovate, reinvest profits to produce even more valuable products and services while at the same time working to reduce their costs. Now, its goal will always be to increase its owner's wealth. That's as a function of the share price, as well as their current income. Now, that's in the form of cash dividends. And those cash dividends, now we're talking the S&P 500, okay, have been growing at twice the rate of consumer inflation since 1980. So alone, you've got inflation hedge, if you will, by dividend income without having to totally rely on your appreciation to make up the difference. That will not happen with bonds 98% of the time. So on these facts, therefore, I believe a reasonable observer would seem it more likely to view stocks as safe and the Treasury's debt and other fixed income with substantial risks. Now, the market prices of even the highest quality companies are, yes, we know, subject to frequent, often significant, but always temporary declines, and are either, or certainly ought to be, irrelevant. I'll try it with my teeth in, irrelevant to you as a long-term investor. What difference does it make what it does day to day? Nothing. You know, where's the trends? Which way is the big picture going? You know, when politics gets involved with economic data, and it certainly gets more involved when you're close to an election of one sort or another, confusion is often the result. Of course, that has nothing to do with the fact that the politicians in question have little or no awareness of what it is they're talking about in economic cases many times. That's neither here nor there. But when you hear the term that, quote, inflation is falling, unquote, what they mean is that prices are still rising, just not as fast as they were. Now, there's this thing called the PCE price index. That's the Fed's favorite measure of inflation. And it's up 3% over the past year. And that's versus a gain of 6.3 in the year ending October of 22. So the core prices of that index are up 3.5% in the past year versus 5.3 a year ago. So it looks as if the process is going to continue with, on one hand, the consumer prices are still going to be climbing somewhat, but at a slower pace. And yes, you'll see, if you will, the big stuff is already starting to drop significantly. But the stuff that we see, you know, the groceries and all those other things, with the exception of gasoline, perhaps, have yet to move. So they might, consumer prices, again, climbing, but at a slower rate. And I would suspicion that at some point they're going to stop going up at the same rate they have been. Now, sorry, I just had to throw that in there. Going back to why stocks and periods of uncertainty, you know, mainstream American companies, well, public companies, those you can invest in, have in fact been heaping up their shareholders' capital at a 7% compound rate above inflation for at least the last 100 years. That ain't bad. And owning a diversified portfolio of these outfits has not been just massively profitable to investors, but effortlessly so. Now, effortlessly means not that it doesn't take work to find them and watch them and all that stuff, but once you got them together, just put them on cruise mode, go to the couch, break out some bonbons, look out the window, watch TV, whatever, but don't get all jumping around in your portfolio just because some wackadoodle is saying that, well, the sky is falling because I got hit in the head with an acorn. You know, it's just not worth it. So on these facts, that there were facts in there, I promise, I believe a reasonable observer, again, would more likely see stocks as safe and treasury or debt, not so much. We know that the market prices of even the highest quality companies can be subject to frequent and almost significant, but always temporary declines, and they should be irrelevant to you. The billionaire stock investor Ron Barron, who runs a series of mutual funds, he's got about $45 billion under management. He said just the other day, "I've never owned a bond in my life, and now you know why. You don't have to own bonds in order to have a good portfolio." So, but if things are so bad, why did the S&P hit a new high yesterday? You wouldn't do that if the world was ending. And again, the Dow hit a total return high this past week. Those gains don't happen just because. If you look at the one-day sale in 1987, some call it a crash, and look where we are now. Look at the market cut in half by the dot-com bust. The Nasdaq was down 80%. Sorry you missed that one, I'll bet. Look where we are now. Look at the what they call the global financial crisis and the bug crash. Look where we are now. Higher. In the 13 years, well, almost 13 years, from its closing low in March of 2009 to its most recent all-time high in January of last year, the S&P 500 went up 7 times and delivered an average annual compound return in excess of 17%. Now, that is not guaranteed. That is not for sure every time, and that's the trade-off with bonds and stocks. But 17 is a whole lot more than 5. And 5 is the best you've seen for a long time. More realistically, those things, short-term things, are paying like 2 and 3%, which puts you upside down in terms of real return when you factor in inflation and taxes. So where does that leave those of us who try to invest intelligently for retirement or who are already retired and quite legitimately concerned about the stability of our investments? Well, after this two-year and open-ended gauntlet of negative trends and developments, where do we find ourselves? Well, one answer is it leaves us down just 4% from the all-time high. 4% from the all-time high. But let's be safe and put everything in a 5% something. Stock short-term behavior often defies basic logic, sort of like the emotions that drive the day-to-day wobbles. Short-term, stocks' popularity goes all over the place due to investors' feelings and their heat-of-the-moment reactions to headlines. Sometimes those are up feelings, sometimes they're down. And there, of course, there's also a lot of noise from those friendly traders out there. But long-term, all that feeling nonsense tends to even out in the weighing of fundamental reality. The markets tend to predict where we're going to be 3 to 30 months out as a way to help shape your expectations. So when you reflect back on market history, you can see that it's pretty dang accurate. And so if that's the case, and you look at the way the markets are doing here lately, and you say, okay, 3 to 30 months out, blah, 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 doesn't suggest that it's going down a lot. Doesn't suggest it, doesn't mean it won't. Now, staying calm through the wobbles, being anti-fragile, if you will, isn't fun during the wobble itself, never is. It's the only way we know to benefit from the rebounds and the stock's overall long-term bull market returns necessary to support things like your cash flow and retirement. The proverbial bottom line. This rally has actually been a lot broader than it gets credit for. For example, in the Wall Street Journal, they said, without Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Nvidia, Tesla, and Facebook, the high-growth technology-related companies that analysts have dubbed the Magnificent Seven, without their results this year, the S&P would only be up 9%. Okay. So that poses a challenge for investors who increasingly are using index funds. So if you're buying an S&P 500 tracker, ETF or fund, whatever, means you're really investing 30% of your money in just 7 stocks. Now, historically, the top 7 have accounted for 21% of the benchmark. That's through an average through the end of the last decade. But this is counter to the principle of diversification. It also means the most important stocks you own are pricey. Those 7 stocks have posted strong profits lately, yeah. But they're still trading at an average of 32 times forward earnings, compared with just 19 times for the broader index. But it hasn't just been the Magnificent 7. Through Tuesday's close, 310 of the S&P 500 companies have had positive year-to-date returns. 4, in addition to Facebook and Nvidia, had triple-digit returns. Another 7 joined Tesla in the 75 to 100% return category. Microsoft and Amazon had 26 other bedfellows in the 50 to 75% bracket. Apple and Alphabet, 48th and 50th best of the lot, respectively. Yeah, so yes, still a bit top-heavy. But nowhere near the degree headlines allege, and if you strip away the best performers, the statements about 493 stocks being down is either wrong or just cherry-picked at best. If you have a diversified portfolio of quality companies that stretches beyond those 7 companies and across the universe of sectors and countries, which you think you should for risk management, then you've likely done just fine this year. And those are my thoughts for the day. Except for one more. Go Zags. We need to smoosh those husky people over there. Make grape juice out of their purples. So, anyhow, they're on tonight. Cheer them on to final victory, folks. Hope you have a wonderfully positive, productive week. We'll be back next Saturday with more market musings, and I thank you very much for listening. I hope you found it helpful. My name is Mike Mayle. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and you've been listening to Money Management.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayle. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.